Welcome to Dealmaker Diaries, where business meets opportunity. The podcast that takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of commercial real estate and mergers and acquisitions. Join us as we unravel the secrets behind the rise and fall of industry titans, explore lucrative investment strategies, and dive deep into the captivating stories that shape the ever-evolving landscape of business. Through in-depth interviews with industry experts, CEOs, and influential thought leaders, we uncover the hidden gems of commercial real estate, unveil the secrets of lucrative property acquisitions, learn how to identify emerging markets, and gain a deep understanding of the negotiation tactics that seal million-dollar deals. But that's not all. Dealmaker Diaries also delves into the thrilling world of mergers and acquisitions. Discover the stories behind high-profile mergers, hear from the masterminds who orchestrated billion-dollar transactions, and gain exclusive insights into the strategies and intricacies of successful M&A deals. Whether you're a seasoned investor or a curious listener, Dealmaker Diaries offers a treasure trove of knowledge, empowering you to make informed decisions, spot lucrative opportunities, and navigate the ever-changing tides of the commercial real estate and M&A markets. Available on all major podcast platforms, subscribe today and let us be your trusted guide in the fascinating world of commercial real estate and mergers and acquisitions.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of Dealmaker Diaries. Today, we have with us our special guest, Mr. Ronald Drapkin. Ronald is the author of Beverly Hills Spy and a scholar with peer-reviewed articles on Japanese espionage. Ronald's passion for the world of espionage dates back to his childhood days in Los Angeles, where a mysterious undercurrent ran through his family. Little did he know then, but his father was deeply involved in U.S. military counterintelligence. As Ronald grew older, the layers of his family's covert history unraveled. It turned out that his grandfather, too, had a secret life in the business. This revelation ignited a relentless pursuit for truth, leading Ronald to sift through previously classified documents on three continents. His quest for understanding took him on a gripping journey through the shadows of espionage history. Before he turned his experiences into captivating narratives, Ronald's professional journey led him through the dynamic landscape of early-stage startups in the United States. He was an early adopter of advertising platforms like Google and Facebook, showcasing his knack for staying ahead of the curve. Now Ronald Drapkin resides in the heart of Tokyo, adding an international flair to his already intriguing life story. Today we'll unravel the layers of Ronald's past, explore the secrets he's uncovered, and gain insights to the world of espionage that have shaped his perspectives. So without further ado, let's dive into another edition of Dealmaker Diaries with our guest, Ronald Drapkin. Let's go. So Ron, welcome to the show. Nice to have you on today.
Thank you, Donald. Happy to be here.
Absolutely, absolutely. So Ron, yeah, I mean, this is a very interesting book you've written. Could you provide a brief overview of the incredible story of Frederick Rutland and the British World War I hero turned spy for Japan, as outlined in your upcoming book?
Sure. Yeah, Frederick Rutland was quite the war hero of World War One. He was the first person to ever take off his plane from a ship in a battle. So in World War One, the British and the German fleets were about to clash, and his little plane took off. And here is, you know, there's 250 ships below and one little plane. So he's quite the hero of early naval aviation. What happened was he was a low class guy. You know, Britain, particularly then, was very class conscious. His other fellow pilots were, you know, from the military academy or Oxford, Cambridge, whatever. And he was a son of a laborer. His dad was actually a day laborer. You know, the lowest paid, you know, barely surviving kind of guy who joined the Navy age 14. He lied about his age to go in. He was 5'3", undernourished, and he kind of bulked up a little bit after joining. And he got to be, you know, just based on hard work and excellence.
Yeah, because I was thinking most of the pilots, they they're like officers, right? So yeah, how do you manage to become an officer, just like you said, through hard work and discipline?
Hard work and discipline. To become a pop officer, the hardest part, even if you were really good, is you have to pass the college level test, for English and math and, high school, middle school dropout. He had to really, bust his behind to do it, but he was able to do it just out of, hard work and smarts and a chip on his
Grit.
shoulder.
Mm.
After World War I ended, there was a bunch of issues. You could say, was it his class? Was it his attitude? He wasn't quite as politically savvy as some. He wasn't getting ahead in the post-World War I thing, and he was looking for a new job. He walked right into the Japanese Navy office in London and said, "Hey, I'm looking for a job." And they said, "Wow, we've been looking for exactly someone like you." And they brought him over to Japan and trained him up. And within about 10 years, it turned out they needed the Japanese needed someone on the ground in California, and someone who was smart and knows aircraft and could be a good spy, could really blend in. And they chose him, and so they set him up in a house. I looked on Zillow, the house in Beverly Hills, up in the up with a view, is it's currently going for $14 million. That was the house he was in. And a lot of spies are kind of in the secret, in the background. You don't notice him there. James Bond is not a very what do you call it, realistic thing most of the time, but he was actually like that. He was very glamorous. None of the Americans could tell he was lower class, and he liked that, right? He's like, I'm a upper class Englishman, right? Going around. And a lot of the early Hollywood actors were British. So in the book, we've got Charlie Chaplin, I got Boris Karloff, I got Nigel Bruce, all these Douglas Fairbanks. And so he was able to kind of blend in with the movie colony while doing his espionage.
So were there any key factors that led him to becoming a spy for Japan versus wanting to do that for his home country?
Yeah, they didn't seem to like him in his home country. They where they say the guy you go to war with is may not be the guy who's going to get ahead during peacetime. How much of that was class? It's hard to say.
And that, I mean, that had to be a incredibly dangerous undertaking as well. I mean, it was. Was he concerned about his life at all?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And it kept getting worse and worse, because as Pearl Harbor is getting closer and closer, it seemed, in the beginning he was taking a lot of money from Japan, and they're like, in case there's a war with the US, and no one thought that would really happen. But as time went on and war came, it was clear the war was coming. It became more and more dangerous for him, right?
So did he give them intel that led to the attacks on Pearl Harbor?
He certainly appears to have done so. So he would just go to Japan, and he'd just stop off in Pearl Harbor. The ship would, he'd go to Honolulu, he'd get off, you look around for a week, and then you go on to Japan. And then the planes that attacked Pearl Harbor, they were designed with help from him. So he basically would send his people in to the aircraft factories in California, Lockheed and Douglas and all those folks. Steal the secrets and send him on. So not only was he on the ground in Pearl Harbor, but he was contributing to making the carrier attack force and the planes that made the attack.
Wow, yeah, that's incredibly impressive. So what initially drew you to Rutland's story, and how did you come across this fascinating tale?
Well, it's kind of crazy, but it seems like he was a friend of the family. So I don't have all the information because they kept it quiet, but my dad and grandfather both worked in intelligence. So my dad was going around LA working for the US military, rounding up foreign spies. He didn't talk too much about it, but after dad passed away, I was trying to figure out, what the heck did dad do? And it should be declassified by now. And so, Donald, it's kind of funny. You can write the FBI, anyone can. You can send them an email right now and give them the name of someone, and if there's a file to share, they'll share it with you, right?
Really?
Or they'll tell you, we don't have anything. They won't tell you it's classified. They'll either say, here it is, or we don't have anything for you. And, you know, looking into, you know, my family's, you know, friends and other spies in LA at the time, I sent an email to the FBI and it came back, here you go, just declassified. So the other thing you'll find about if you ever, you know, call up the FBI or write the FBI to ask for old files, they don't, if they declassify something new and hot, they're not going to tell anyone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like if they're going to go to classify some new stuff for Kennedy, I doubt they're going to announce it, right? It's going to be there. And so it was just sort of dumb luck that I asked the FBI if they had a file on Frederick Rutland and it came back and I'm like, wow, this thing's just been declassified.
They just email it to you or they mail it to you?
Yeah. Yeah. They email it to you or they send you a hard copy. You can choose.
So digging just a little deeper, how did he manage to gather this strategic and technical intelligence, considering the challenges and risks involved in these operations? Especially back then, I mean, because they didn't have, you know, it wasn't email, it wasn't flash drives or any of that. So yeah, how did he manage to gather this and get it back to his cohorts?
Yeah, you know, you can get, if people don't suspect you, and, you know, this tall, you know, British guy was the last person in the world who would be suspected of being a Japanese spy. You can get these people drunk. You can get people drunk and ask them a lot of questions and they'll just tell you, you know, he's like, I used to fly planes off carriers in Britain. How's your plane going? You know, and you invite an admiral into your house party in the hills and, you know, you have some actors around and they'll tell you quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That was step one. And the step two is just, you know, hiring people to go into the factories. So the FBI files have got a great story about, you know, he hired this Irish guy to go in and work at Lockheed. The Irish guy was, he used to work for Boris Karloff, who was a friend of Rutland. Hired him, sent him into Lockheed as a night janitor. And, you know, you might not think about this too much unless you're really into spies, but night janitor is a perfect job if you're trying to steal secrets.
Yeah, it is, right?
A guy that can go anywhere at the plan at night, right?
Right.
So that was the second way to do it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, as I'm thinking about it right now, I would think, you'd almost think maybe it was easier back then because, yeah, it wasn't all the cameras. They weren't tracking passports and everything easily like they are now. So maybe it was even easier back then, huh?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I hadn't thought about that. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So his ability to blend into both Los Angeles high society and Japan's high command is intriguing, I think. Can you share some anecdotes or examples of his interactions with Hollywood stars and military dignitaries during this period?
Yeah, there is a club in Los Angeles, the British United Services Club, which is where the British actors and military vets get together. It's in Hollywood, exists today. And, you know, he just, he joined as a British military veteran and he volunteered to actually coordinate the parties. So if you look at the old newspaper accounts, you know, they always say there's a big party. Charlie Chaplin's going to be there. Mm. It's, you know, the all male parties, you know, you're in a suit or you're in a kilt if you're Scottish. Those are the two options, right?
Yeah.
Or military, you know, thing. And, he's like, I'll set the party up, right? And so he's talking with all these guys. He's doing the invites. He's, you know, so like I say, you can get a lot of information from people when they're drunk if they don't suspect you, right?
Yeah. And you mentioned writing the FBI, but outside of requesting information from the FBI, how else did you gather your research for this project?
Yeah, I got a bunch from MI5 because they were tracking him.
Okay. And they operate the same as the FBI? You just request information?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then since I'm in Japan, I was able to get some things from the Japanese archives as well.
Okay. So what was Japan's end game in using him to gather this intelligence? So what was supposed to happen after the war? Were they just going to say, okay, this relationship is now ended, or... What was the end game?
They were having some problems, but if you're familiar with the term sleeper, they were hoping he'd be a sleeper. So, you know, there were Japanese agents in the embassy and the consulate in the US. And of course, when the war started, obviously those folks would be taken out. So the plan was to do two things. One was to set up espionage operations in Mexico. So you could just go right over the border, send people in, intercept and communications, and then have this guy in Los Angeles. So he'd still go to these parties. He'd still get people drunk. He'd still find out what the U.S. Navy was doing and either go over the border to Tijuana himself or pass it over to them, to someone, right? That was the plan. So it's, the whole point of a sleeper is that, you don't know they're there until you need them.
Okay. And just activate them anytime. All right.
Yeah. But they didn't stick with that. They wanted more information. So they were using them before, but the idea was still the same. Activate the sleeper when the war starts.
Okay. Yeah. And so after they attacked Pearl Harbor and the war, and that, I mean, that pretty much got U.S. into the war. How did that affect his role then? What happened with him then? Especially after they surrendered.
Yeah. And unfortunately for him, we get into this in the book, but basically the Navy intelligence was working with him, and the FBI got onto him as well. Mm-hmm. And the FBI and the State Department were like, holy moly, this is really hot, right? This mm-hmm. is like a world famous British war hero who's actually working for the wrong side, right?
Yeah.
And they said, look, they went to him and said, look, we need to keep this quiet. And you're not allowed to spy for Japan anymore. And they decided to send him back to Britain. Send him back to Britain and have the Brits take care of him. And the Brits, they basically promised him that he might be able to help out with a war effort back in Britain. And the Brits kind of, did they screw him? Or did they just kind of take care of a problem? So they basically arrested him and threw him in Brixton prison, where he was out there for the war.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, he got off lucky. They didn't hang him or shoot him. So,
after the war ended, he mysteriously committed suicide, and it's not well documented. MI5 back then, they weren't nice people. Mm-hmm. You may be familiar with the story about Alan Turing.
Yeah, a little bit. I've heard that name. Yeah, a little bit.
Like the code breakers.
Yeah, I saw that movie, I believe. Yeah,
I don't really want to speculate too much, but I do speculate that maybe he didn't really commit suicide. Maybe someone knocked him off.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, in your opinion, Ron, in what ways does Rutland's story resonate with contemporary themes, and what lessons can be drawn from his experiences in espionage and international intrigue?
Yeah, well, the story about foreigners coming to California and stealing U.S. military technology is evergreen, and it's a big issue even today,
yeah.
Right? In fact,
absolutely.
A spy was arrested. I think I saw it in the news just a couple days ago. Someone stealing U.S. Navy info.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I saw that as well.
Yeah,
and it goes on all over the world, right? You hear about it in Russia, China, Iran, everywhere. So yeah,
absolutely.
It's an evergreen game that's always being played, I guess.
Yeah. And for whatever reason, California's the place, for the technology, Silicon Valley, and that's where people go to steal things.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So let's shift gears a bit and explore the business side of this, Ron.
Yeah.
So can you share your experience in securing a book deal for this unique and compelling story? What were the key considerations and challenges in bringing Rutland's tale to a wider audience?
Sure. Yeah. And it's, I'm a first time author. I haven't done this before. And I did get the contract, which is actually kind of a miracle, actually, if you think about it. I got the book deal based on just some crazy new declassified information, right? I don't have a platform. I don't have a million social media followers. I'm not the, Yeah, so I knew I had this really hot story and I needed to get it out there. Mm-hmm. And as a nobody, it was like, well, how do you do this, right? And the real break was I actually found some reporters who would write the story in newspapers.
Okay.
Right. So I knew calling up a book company, book publisher agent wouldn't work. But, reporters, journalists, they're always looking for a good story. And so I found the folks that write about Hollywood history, at all the Southern California newspapers. And I called them up and they bit. Yeah. And so they wrote a couple articles about me, and the British press picked it up as well, saying, wow, this is some crazy new declassified information. So that I was able to package up into a proposal for the agent in the publishing houses.
Okay. So when you presented that to those reporters, was there a concern that you could lose control of it and be edged out, and they take it from there? Were you concerned about that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't think I had a choice though.
Okay. Yeah, if you wanted to get it out there, you just.
Absolutely was concerned.
Okay. So given the unique name, so once you got this, so once it started picking up traction in the press, you approached some publishers,
Yeah, that's
correct?
right.
So how many publishers did you approach?
I started by, the best way to get a well, there's two kinds of book deals, right? There's one with a publishing house and the one you do it yourself, right? Both are valid. I decided to go the traditional route, like get an agent, get a publishing house, and see how that goes. Figuring, why not try it, right? If you want to do a self-publishing, you can do that now, right? You can just go to Amazon, upload your book. And
Yeah, I've taken that route, so yeah.
that does work on occasion, although it's a tough grind. It seems like, for independent publishing, maybe from what I understand, talking to people is if you've written a romance novel, right, the publishing houses get, 10,000 inquiries about my new romance novel, every day or every week or whatever, right? So that's a good one for independent publishing. I was going on the idea that maybe I had something, declassified FBI documents, Pearl Harbor, Hollywood, that people would pick it up. And it was still a rough road. So, I mean, I contacted a couple dozen agents. You go through, and it's just hard work. You just go through, like, okay, which agents like this kind of story, and go to other books, and who's their agent, and you call them up, and I finally got one, but it was a good, 3, 4, 5 months.
Okay. Yeah, I would imagine crafting a compelling pitch is crucial. So what elements did you emphasize when you're pitching his story to publishers, and how did you convey its marketability and appeal to a broad audience?
So that was one of the things when I found my agent at the Watermark Agency. That was actually one of the things they're really good at. They're really good at crafting the pitch. So the pitch to the publishers, it's a good 30 pages,
Okay.
plus sample
Wow.
chapters. So it's yeah. So you're absolutely right, Donald. It's quite the thing. But basically, there's two parts to it. One is that, wow, this is really a great story. This has got it all. It's got, Hollywood, Pearl Harbor, spies, right? And it's already been recognized in the press. And no one's seen this before. It's newly declassified. And that was sort of that was basically, the pitch.
And like you said, you didn't have a platform at all. So did the publishing company have a fix for that, or did they just going to use their platform to promote it and market it? Is that how?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. So as your podcast, Donald, gets bigger and bigger, right? You have a platform, right? And it's getting bigger every day, just, a little bit at a time, getting bigger and bigger, right? So you're actually more the kind of person that would be able to take that and spin it into a deal. Because they knew with me that they were going to have to do most of the marketing, right?
Okay. So, and I mean, as I've heard, I mean, it's striking a balance between artistic vision and commercial viability can be challenging. So how did you maintain the integrity of his story while also ensuring its broad appeal? Were there any compromises you had to make during the publishing process?
A lot less than most people, right? I my personal agenda here was, you know, I found a great story I'd like to tell the world, and let's just do it in the best way, you know, we can do it. Right. So I understand a lot of artists get really bent out of shape about any change to their vision. But I was like, more like, no, you guys are the experts. You know how to get the word out about this. You tell me what's best. Right. And they smacked around my original ideas and they changed things around a little bit. You know, there's this one scene where Frederick Rutland got really, he was really good at making a plane not crash when it landed on an aircraft carrier. So early aircraft carriers, you have these little biplanes. They're like made of sticks. The wind blows, they go over the side, really dangerous. And he helped solve the problem of how to land on an aircraft carrier without crashing. It was a huge deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, the publisher looked at that and he was like, you know, I think people want to hear more about Hollywood. You know, they're like, you know, I see where you're going, but you know, 50 pages on landing, you know, on the landing gear of a plane is not going to be a mainstream thing. And I'm like, you know,
yeah, they're probably right. Right. Yeah.
You're probably right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless you're an engineer or real technical, you're not going to want to hear about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So some engineers would love this, but yeah.
Right.
So that was not a problem at all. You know, I think the one thing on nonfiction is, okay, so what exactly are you allowed to, you know, extrapolate? You know, if I've got like, you know, two people in a room and I've got the FBI document saying what they talked about, in the style of narrative nonfiction, I came, I'm a, you know, fan of. So, you know, it's, I don't know if you know, like Eric Larson or like, Sonia Purnell or some of those folks, you know, they're like, look, you're not allowed to make up stuff, but you're allowed to recreate dialogue to make the story interesting. And so I glommed on to that style.
Okay. So that's interesting because, yeah, so I'm asking who regulates that then? Who decides, are there people out here who are reading these books like, oh, that's, he made that up. So that's, are there laws against that? Can you be fined or can you do jail time for
no
extrapolating, like, or going too far and making stuff up? What happens?
You know, it's a style of publishing and you disclose what you've done.
Okay.
And, you know, I can say that history books that have maybe 100 pages of writing and 50 pages of footnotes are typically not interesting, right?
Right.
So
yeah, because you see, I mean, you see these movies that are created from books and you can see the disclaimers, these characters, some of these characters are fictional. So yeah. Obviously they've made some people up and they've created dialogue to make it more interesting, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, every author has to make their own decision about that. You know, I've made mine and, you know, I've written academic papers with lots of footnotes and people didn't read those.
Okay. Yeah, maybe that's why certain people in the recent news have left those out and gotten into trouble since people aren't reading footnotes anyway.
Yeah.
That I'm sure you hear, you've heard them talk about recently.
That's a good point. Yeah, and Napoleon, the movie, was, you know, a lot of people were talking about how accurate that was. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen it. There's a good documentary on the on World War II on Netflix right now that I looked at a few days ago. It just came out. Maybe you saw it. It's pretty interesting. But they talk about Japan and Germany and Italy, how they were forming an alliance. But yeah, very interesting. So I thought about your book when I was looking at that.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
So Ron, looking ahead, what strategies do you or your publisher have in place for marketing and promoting the book? How do they plan on creating buzz and generating interest both before and after the release? Can you talk about that?
I can talk about kind of in general terms, I'd say. I think most of the publishers would do the same thing. You know, there are publicists that are assigned, and they're the ones that'll do the PR, and they're reaching out to media and, you know, getting coverage. That's one. There's book reviews. So, you know, basically they get the early book, the pre-version in the hands of people who write book reviews. And then you also want to kind of get out to thought leaders. And luckily for this book, there's actually thought leaders in different segments. Right. There's a lot of people out there that just love World War II and Pearl Harbor, right?
Yeah.
There's also a lot of people out there that watch Turner Classic Movies and love old Hollywood, right? There's also a lot
Right.
of people that love British spies. And there's a lot of people out there that love, Japan, right? And
Absolutely.
so basically you reach out to these influencers basically that you think would glom onto it and get them to get them an early version of the book and get them to try to write about it.
Okay. And have there been any talks about if the book proves successful, movie rights or movie deals?
Yeah, that's one good thing about an agent. They know how to work those deals. But yeah, there's definitely been messages coming in from various Hollywood type folks. Golden age of Hollywood. Hollywood loves a lot of topics, but Hollywood definitely loves Hollywood, right?
Yeah, because I could definitely see that being a good movie, Beverly Hills Spy. Even just the title is pretty catchy, so I could
Yeah.
definitely see that.
Yeah, for
Definitely
sure.
see that coming out on Prime or Netflix.
That's the hope.
So, Ron, as you reflect on the journey of securing a book deal for Rutland Story, what advice would you give to aspiring authors navigating the business side of publishing? Are there lessons learned or insights gained that you believe could benefit others in a similar position?
I think it's I'm sort of in a lot of people will be like, well, I'm going to write a book. And you ask them, like, what are you going to write about? And they're like, well, I got to figure that part out. And I was like the opposite, right? I had a story I wanted to tell. I think that's a good way to approach it because it makes it more, kind of passionate, realistic, that kind of thing. Some of my other friends, they don't really want to make money on a book. They want to do a legacy, right? Like a lot of my friends, retired business people, they just want to write down what they've learned and they don't want to compromise anything. And that's also a fine way to do it if you don't really care about making money.
Right.
Right?
Definitely, definitely. And
Yeah.
but of course you've chosen I would say what's your primary concern? Is yours to make money or a little of both, or what was your general goal in writing the book?
My goal was to, get it out there, and if it makes money, great. But I just don't think you can. Well, I know you can't count on it. Like if you want to make a lot of money, or they say don't write a book, don't open a winery, don't open a restaurant,
Don't
don't
start a
start a barrel.
podcast. Yeah.
It's not. I mean, you may make money, but it's like anything in the arts. The odds are low.
So when you decided you wanted to write the book and you floated it by, I'm sure you floated it by friends and family, what was their response? Was everybody positive, or were some people like, you don't even have a chance? What was that experience?
People were pretty supportive. Yeah, I mean they probably thought I was crazy.
And how about family? Who did they did anybody feel you were exploiting the family, or did you have any responses like that or experiences like that?
Yeah, there was some concern about that. My dad, the ex-spook, if he knew about I was writing this, he'd be like, well, he'd probably be proud and spinning in his grave because he went to his grave not saying a word about any of his missions, right? But I think he'd still be proud of it in his own way.
Are you still in touch with anybody? I mean, I'm not sure how old your father was when he passed, but is any of are any of his like brothers or siblings or cousins still alive that you're in contact with?
Yeah, he grew up with a bunch of cousins and they've all been supportive.
Okay, great, great.
Yeah, his old army buddies. There's a couple of them still around. Yeah.
All right. So, Ron, let's put you through a quick lightning round before we hop off.
Yeah.
All right. So, what's your favorite book or books that have greatly impacted your life?
Oh. The ones I like the best are the ones where the author actually helped solve the crime. You've seen that one, I've Been Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara. She was Patton Oswalt's wife who helped solve the California, was it the Freeway Strangler mystery?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah.
She's Japanese.
No, she's she was the wife of that Hollywood actor, Patton Oswalt.
Okay.
And she got obsessed by it was the Golden State Strangler. That was it. 30 years ago. And she I grew up in California, so I heard all about the Golden State Strangler, right? But yeah, she helped solve the mystery herself. The guy got away with so many murders because he was a cop, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
And
And
is there a recent movie on Netflix about that? I think I've seen something like that. Yeah. Okay.
yeah.
Okay. And morning person or night owl?
Morning person.
Morning person. Yeah. So am I.
Yeah.
And one word that describes your style.
Eight-year-olds around a campfire.
8 year olds around a campfire.
Yeah, you ever been in a campfire with a bunch of 8-year-olds? You tell them a story
Okay.
like that. That's
And if
one.
you could, have lunch with any historical figure, who would it be?
Oh, it'd be Frederick Rutland, man. I'd love to ask him, like, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean that was a dangerous undertaking on two folds for American and Britain if anybody caught him.
Yeah.
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 And I was even thinking, if the Japanese decided, well, he's expendable, we can kill him as well, right? So that's some dangerous dealings.
They weren't gonna that wasn't gonna be a problem for them.
So top productivity hack that keeps you on track.
Just every day move the ball forward just a little bit.
Okay.
And if you got the motivation, you want to do it. That's not a problem, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And favorite travel destination to unwind?
Favorite travel destination? Geez. In Japan, Kyushu. Yeah.
Kyushu. Okay.
Yeah, it's
Yeah, I
awesome.
haven't been down to Kyushu yet. I have to get down there. Hear great
Yeah.
things about it.
Yeah.
Okay, and a skill or hobby you're currently working to improve?
Exercise and yeah, like getting my running
Exercise.
game up, yeah,
Okay, more consistently.
more consistently and
Okay. Yeah, if you're out in Koenji right now, you can come out with me. I'm gonna go run after we finish.
Oh,
Yeah.
oh boy. I'm not in Koenji right now, but I certainly could think about it for a future. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, and last one, best way to recharge after a challenging day.
Well, I hate to say it, but I just like to have a beer, which is probably not the best way to do it, but that's my way to do
Well, definitely nothing wrong with that, for sure.
it. Yeah.
All right, excellent. So yeah, Ron, it was great having you on today. We're definitely looking forward to the book. When's the when will it be available for a purchase?
Middle of February.
Middle of February. All right, great. And if anybody wants to get in touch with you, collaborate, find out more about you or your book, what's the best way for them to get in touch?
Facebook group, Beverly Hills Spy.
Okay, Beverly
That's
Hills
probably the
Spy.
best way.
All right, great. We'll run that across the screen as well.
Great.
All right, Ron, thank you so much. It was great having you on. I'm sure I'll see you again soon. I mean, I know we have a date to get pizza soon, so let's make that happen.
Let's do that. Yeah, a run in pizza.
Definitely. All
Yeah.
right, buddy. Thanks a lot. This has
Thanks,
been
Paul.
great. We're looking forward to the book and good luck with that.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Well, folks, that wraps up another insightful episode of Dealmaker Diaries. We hope you enjoyed today's deep dive into the world of strategic deal making. Before we go, a quick reminder. If you like what you heard today and want to stay updated on all things deals, be sure to hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast platform. And hey, we love hearing from our community, so don't forget to leave us a review. Your feedback not only helps us improve, but also lets other deal enthusiasts discover the show. So whether you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, take a moment to share your thoughts. As always, thank you for joining us on Dealmaker Diaries. Keep those negotiation skills sharp. Stay tuned for more expert insights. And until next time, make those deals happen. This is Don Thomas signing off.